On Tech News Today, Amazon bans TV box competitors from Amazon.com. Adblock opens its whitelist to anyone who pays. And Apple's building another spaceship. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, October 2nd, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service that's the most sophisticated way for you to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or just starting out, visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's Wealthfront.com/TNT. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Mashable Senior Tech Correspondent Christina Warren. Hey, Christina, how are you doing today?
I'm good. It is finally fall in New York City, which is fantastic.
Yes, far better than winter or summer, for example.
Yes. Well, this summer especially was just gross and never ending. So I'm very, very happy to be in sub 90 degree temperatures. And it was a little bit gross earlier this week, but the weather today, other than the raining, is fairly nice. So,
oh, nice. Yay. Very nice. All right. Well, we got lots of really, really interesting news to talk about. So let's jump right into it. Amazon has removed TV boxes made by their competitors. Specifically, Amazon sent a letter to marketplace sellers saying it would stop selling Google's Chromecast dongles and Apple TV boxes starting on October 29th. Don Shmilovsky is a senior editor for Recode and joins us to talk about it. Hey, Don, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mike. Good to join you.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, what reason did Amazon give for this move? Although I think you can guess.
How sweet that you think Amazon speaks. So Amazon simply said that it has chosen products that support Amazon Prime. And those would be products such as the Roku and various game consoles. It didn't respond to further questions about what prompted this move, but it seems pretty obvious here. Amazon is investing a lot in its Amazon Prime Video service. Remember, just last weekend, they claimed an Emmy for a couple of Emmys for Transparent, one of its original series. Amazon's really investing in its video service. And so it appears that it no longer... It wants to support its own devices, its Amazon Fire Stick, and its own sort of ecosystem. And so with this vision of the world, it doesn't want to be selling products from its competitors, from Apple and from Google.
So what's interesting about this, Don, is, and you know, I've spoken with, as I'm sure you have, a lot of companies on background and got Amazon's very uninsightful statement, I guess we should say.
Content free.
There you go.
Yeah, that's basically what it was.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's interesting because they claim that they want to support products that support Amazon Instant Video, which is fine, except that for Chromecast support, all they would have to do would be to add support for Chromecast in their own app. Like, literally, that's all they would have to do, exactly. which kind of puts their argument, at least on the Google side, at odds with what they're saying. Do you agree?
I totally agree. I mean, you know, here it is a choice that Amazon is making. And the choice may relate to the 30% fee that Apple and Google collect for purchases that are made through apps, either through the subscriptions that are obtained through the app or for purchases of, say, video, you know, say someone wants to buy a movie or television show through Amazon. Amazon would have to share 30% of that revenue with its competitors. It seems like this is a conscious decision on Amazon's part not to in any way benefit its competitors in video.
Don, should Apple ban Amazon's app from the App Store and should Google ban Amazon's app from the Play Store? And if
Don't
not, why
say
not?
This. Don't say this, Mike.
I would be loath to offer advice to either of those giants. They seem to be doing pretty well without my advice.
All right. Well, just to pursue that a little bit more, wouldn't that be roughly comparable? I mean, this is a company that's playing dirty tricks. I mean, I don't think it's illegal, but it's clearly not very nice. It's really not very fair, et cetera. Wouldn't it be reasonable for the companies to strike back? And if in other words, if everybody did what Amazon is doing, what would that look like?
I mean, that's a fair question, but let's not be short-sighted here. Apple has made choices in its own retail store to stop selling products made by competitors. Remember, last year after it completed the purchase of its Beats, the headphone business and the music service, all of a sudden other makers of high-end headphones were no longer available in Apple stores. Similarly, when Apple launched the Apple Watch, a number of other wearables started disappearing from Apple stores. So these are companies that make choices that benefit themselves. I mean, that's the heart of capitalism. So Apple has certainly made similar sorts of decisions here.
What's interesting to me about this, Don, is that Amazon seems to be trying to have things both ways. On the one hand, they have this video service, which obviously, if you take the Netflix and the Hulu and the HBO approach, benefits only by being on as many platforms as possible. So in that case, you want to be on as many devices as possible. So that means having an iOS app. That means potentially supporting Google Play. That means being on Blu-ray players, being on Roku. On the other hand, by basically saying we're not going to carry competitor products because they don't support us, they are kind of, as Mike was saying, almost daring Amazon, or not Amazon, daring Apple to say, okay, well, we're just not going to let the Amazon Instant Video app in the App Store anymore, which would be terrible for consumers. What does this say, do you think, about kind of like Amazon historically has been a fairly customer-centric company, at least from the outside, if not all of their internal dealings? This strikes me as a completely anti-customer move. What do you think that says about what their real plans are, I guess, going forward with the living room? And could you see them doing this to other products, you know, not carrying other, you know, e-readers? Not that I even think they exist anymore, but I guess tablets would be a good example. Would they stop carrying iPads?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, clearly Amazon is still selling tablets, even though it has a competing product in the marketplace. You know, I don't know. You know, I guess consumers will decide whether they feel that they want to continue to shop at Amazon or not. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what to say beyond that.
And that's the depressing fact, isn't it? Because consumers, we all know, will not care. As long as the shipping is fast and the buying is easy, they're going to keep doing it. And
honestly, at this point, what's Amazon's competitor? I mean, right. Legitimately, I mean, like there aren't a lot of options for somebody who has the depth and breadth of an Amazon.
Yeah, although there are certainly large big box retailers out there in the world, sure, that have an online presence. Interesting, you know, you raise a good point that Amazon has become a default for people who are shopping online. So there's not a tremendous amount of risk to Amazon for taking these sorts of moves.
Yeah, that's the thing I think that's so stark about this. Amazon sells everything except the Apple TV and Google Chrome.
And frankly, you know, although presumably Amazon does risk some sort of retaliatory move, which would not really benefit a company like Apple to limit, to make a move that would deliberately, say, limit the kind of video content that its users would have access to. That would be counter to its interests. But, you know, they seem like, yeah. We'll see. We'll see if consumers react in some way to rebel against this.
All right. Well, great story. Don Shmilovsky is at Recode.net and on Twitter at DonC331. Don, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. More news coming right up. But first, let's talk about Wealthfront, one of our sponsors today. Wealthfront is an automated investment service that will help you hang on to much more of your money and grow it. And that's exactly what you're going to want to do. It's the new way. It's the sort of technology way to invest. Wealthfront makes it super easy for anyone to access world-class long-term investment management, and you can get started investing today at a minimum of $500. You sign up for your account at wealthfront.com/TNT, and in just a few minutes, it goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock and taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. It's like the ideal investment consultant-type person who never sleeps. You sign up for an account, and it just is amazing. Whether you're investing for retirement, for a different long-term goal, Wealthfront automatically rebalances your portfolio and reinvests your dividends all commission-free. And I think that's one of the most important parts. They manage over $2.6 billion in client assets, and they've grown to over 20 times in the past 2 years. So join Wealthfront and start investing your money the right way. Visit Wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for you, TWIT listeners and viewers, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Claim your offer today at Wealthfront.com/TNT. For compliance purposes, I have to tell you that Wealthfront, Inc. is an SEC-registered investment advisor. Brokerage services are offered through Wealthfront Brokerage Corporation, member FINRA, and SIPC. This is not a solicitation to buy or sell securities. Investing in securities involves risks, and there is a possibility of losing money. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. Please visit Wealthfront.com to read their full disclosure. Apple is planning to build what is being described as a second spaceship campus, and this one is in the city of Sunnyvale. Nate Donato-Weinstein writes for Silicon Valley Business Journal and joins us to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Hey, Mike. Thrilled to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, let's talk about the location. How big is this piece of land? What's on it now? And what is in the surrounding area?
Well, it's about 18 acres, which is a pretty large site in the valley. And kind of the cool thing about it is that it's like that old 1970s stuff from the valley. That's that like tilt up concrete construction that looks really awful and that no one really wants to work in anymore. And so it's a real symbol of this changing nature of real estate in the valley, where you have this pretty amazing proposal to replace it with what I kind of called a second spaceship, because it's like really round. I mean, the thing is huge. It's almost 800,000 square feet, which is, to be sure, not as big as Apple's campus under construction right now, Apple Campus 2, which is about 3 million square feet. But you can see some real similar design cues. Apple didn't come up with this design themselves. It was a third-party developer who proposed this and has now, you know, leased the project, which has not yet, you know, started construction, to Apple. They could fit, assuming they build it all, about, you know, more than 3,000 employees in there. And it's really the continuation of a trend we've seen all year of just insane growth from Apple to really lock up expansion space really all over the valley now.
So the website to promote this campus is called notanotherbox.com. Can you talk about the website a little bit?
I love the marketing. It's so perfect, right? Because they're the developer Land Bank, which is a family firm that actually built the old buildings that are there now back in the 60s and 70s, is really trying to tie into this trend going on where you have these tech companies that are really thinking differently about the kind of workplace they want to have. And, you know, Apple was a leader in that trend with the spaceship proposed back, you know, a couple of years ago. And now we've seen Google come out with these amazing glass dome buildings, which they're going to build. NVIDIA has a pretty incredible design for a campus that looks kind of like a polygon thing. And Facebook, of course, is doing really cool stuff in Menlo Park. And so, you know, what this third-party developer did was say, I think this is what tech companies want, is these different designs from the usual, you know, kind of boring suburban architecture, and just came out and kind of said, look, we know that the kind of the existing approach to real estate is just really boring. And so let's do something different. And it's certainly not a box.
Now, is this uncharacteristic for Apple? I mean, first of all, it's not a Cupertino. Second of all, it's not something they're buying. I mean, Apple has so much money, they could literally build an actual spaceship and house all their employees in it in space. So is it uncharacteristic for them to be leasing and accepting an innovative design that looks like it's going to be somewhat iconic for Apple as well, in addition to the giant bagel? And, you know, it looks like they're really tapping into Apple's pushing their buttons, if you will, with all the curved glass and so on. But is this an unusual move for Apple? How does Apple normally choose and pay for its campuses that are not the central one or two campus?
I think that's a really good question, and I totally want to steal the bagel descriptor for the Campus 2 from now on. It is a little different, and I mean, to be sure, you know, it may be that Apple will want to change things with this project. I mean, we don't know. In some ways, you know, there is the chance that this is more about locking down the real estate than it is about the design. I mean, I don't know. But the fact is, you know, they did like it enough to lease it. It's true that they have leased a lot of space that's very traditional Silicon Valley stuff, and that would not get anyone excited, right? But they really exploded out of Cupertino a couple of years ago into Sunnyvale and Santa Clara, and so that's not new. What is new is that in the past few months, they've started to make a big push now into San Jose. And this is where things get really interesting, because the kind of stuff they're doing in San Jose, where they're buying land now, Apple itself is buying land, big sites. They bought 40 acres a couple of weeks ago in San Jose by the airport. They just bought another 20-something acres last week. They could do some really interesting stuff there. And, you know, the last time Apple bought a lot of land was the spaceship site in Cupertino, which they bought. It was the former Hewlett-Packard campus. And so when Apple starts buying stuff, I think it's like a sign that they might have some really interesting plans there. And there's a ton of rumors out there in the marketplace about what Apple might end up doing at these various sites. And so, you know, the big one that's making the rounds in San Jose is that it could be connected to R&D regarding their car project. And so, you know, they haven't turned in any building plans, but everyone is kind of wondering, you know, what are they going to do there? And that's, I think, going to be an even bigger story than the Not Another Box building deal from this week, is when we finally learn what Apple has up its sleeve. But as you know, it's really hard to really know for sure before Apple, you know, gets up on stage and says what their plans are.
Yeah, and they're a pretty slow-moving company as well, so I don't think anything's going to happen right away. I, for one, would like to see them build tunnels underneath Silicon Valley, connecting all their various campuses and connected by electric self-driving Apple cars. But that's
okay.
Just me.
I mean, you bring up a good point, right? Which is all of this expansion creates some challenges for the region about, you know, traffic and just like I did some math before coming on the show today. And if you add it all up, you know, they could fit potentially, if they built everything and occupied everything, over 20,000 new workers in addition to the people they already have. I don't think they're going to do that. But like as a thought exercise, where would you put that many new people? And that's when I think things get interesting, too, is to, you know, think through what does this expansion mean for the region's infrastructure and housing?
Yeah, that is a good point. And your reference to Apple occupying Silicon Valley makes it sound like a military invasion occupied Silicon Valley today. Anyway, so we'll see what happens with Apple. Nate Donato-Weinstein is at bizjournals.com and on Twitter at SVBizNate. Nate, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, bye-bye. Remember the stage fright exploit that hit Android this summer? Don't look now, but it's back. Ryan Whitwam is an independent technology journalist who wrote about the story for Extreme Tech and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Now, before we talk about the old stage fright, can you, or before we talk about the new one, can you remind us what the old one was all about?
So the last time we heard about stage fright, it was an MMS vulnerability. So basically somebody would send you an MMS message. It had a video in it that contained code that would exploit this flaw in Android. Stage fright is actually not the name of the exploit itself. It's the name of a media handler library in Android. So it basically just allowed an attacker to run remote code on your device. Which is obviously a big security problem.
So is this a new version of the old stage fright? Like what's exactly going on?
This is very similar to the original stage fright. But instead of MMS, it's basically using a browser. You would be mm-hmm. directed to a page that hosts a malformed video or audio file. And then very, you know, a similar sort of thing, they would be able to run arbitrary code on your device. But there are sort of two different vulnerabilities involved in this one. It still uses the Stagefright library, but it also is calling back to a core Android library called called libutils. And this is actually the library that's in every Android phone. This is why those there are all those headlines saying, you know, a billion Android devices vulnerable. Technically, the way this exploit is described, it's only dangerous for Lollipop devices because the part of Stagefright that actually allows access to the core Android stuff, that vulnerability was only introduced in 5.0. But the core stuff still needs to be updated because there could be other ways into it. And, you know, and it's not feasible to go through and check everything to make sure it doesn't make the same sort of dangerous API call that Stagefright does. So they're just going to patch the core library too. But of course, when these patches are developed for Google, they already have them done. They're in AOSP, the Android Open Source Project. But, you know, Google rolls them out to Nexus devices. Then you have to wait for OEMs to take that code and put it into their ROMs and roll them out to devices. And so this is sort of the ongoing issue with Android updates, is that it takes time to roll out. So the last time we heard about Stagefright, Samsung and LG both said they were going to start doing monthly security updates to mitigate this sort of thing. So presumably, these patches will roll out quicker than last time, but we still don't know, you know, how big of a problem that'll be for smaller OEMs. But that, of course, implies that there's a problem with Stagefright. Nobody's ever actually used it to exploit a device in real life. It's all sort of theoretical.
Just a go ahead, Christina.
No, I was going to say it's theoretical, but I mean, in this case, I mean, going through MMS is one thing. I mean, I would think that going through, you know, a browser kind of redirect would make this potentially, you know, a lot more vulnerable to users because it could be exploited, you know, at least, you know, theoretically or in practice in a lot more dangerous ways. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that of course implies that there's an exploit that you can actually utilize the Stagefright, because this is just sort of this sort of opens the door to a device. You still have to have some sort of other exploit that you can load in to, you know, steal data or take control of a device. This just, you know, gives you an opportunity. But if you can actually just, you know, drop this on a web page and redirect somebody there, yeah, that could be a lot more dangerous. But I think that also sort of illustrates how hard it is to use things like Stagefright. If it were really that easy, I feel like we would have seen a lot more exploits. Well, we would have seen at least some exploits based
on
Stagefright.
Right, we've seen something, right.
Interesting. Ryan Whitwam is at ryanwhitwam at .com, and also you can find him on Twitter at Ryan Whitwam. Ryan, thanks for coming on Tech News Today.
Thanks for having me.
The popular ad blocking software company Adblock has been acquired. The trouble is nobody knows who bought it. Reporters contacting Adblock have been told that the buyer specifically demanded that the sale be kept secret. Also, yesterday, Adblock started displaying a pop-up message to users saying that it now allows iOS acceptable advertising. That means advertisers can pay to have their ads added to the whitelist. Adblock has more than 40 million users who use extensions on Chrome and Safari browsers. Christina Warren, I smell a rat. This doesn't sound very good, does it?
No, it sure doesn't. This is, if anybody's watching the video feed, I'm kind of rolling my eyes because this is sort of the problem with these ad blocker things. And I'm not one of those journalists who gets super religious about, oh no, you can't use ad blockers because, I mean, come on, we've all used them. There's certainly purposeful reasons, whether it's security or simply page loading that they exist. But it's problematic to me when A, you sell your company and you disclose it in the way they disclosed it, which was very kind of hidden. So we don't even know when this was sold. We just know that this disclosure happened now. And B, all of a sudden it says, okay, well, we're an ad blocker and we've been begging you to donate to our cause because we're, you know, donationware. But now we're saying, actually, you know what? You can pay to get your ads whitelisted. And we're just going to have to trust that this IO company actually, they have really good intentions and they are the arbiters of what makes a good ad and a bad ad and what makes something respect privacy and what doesn't. Not the, you know, IASB or any of the actual professional ad groups, but this company who's accepting money from advertisers to allow their ads in. We're going to trust them to say that what's okay and what's not. So the whole thing is, like you said, it's a smell of rats. I also wouldn't be surprised if, doesn't IO, they own Adblock Plus, don't they?
I'd have to check on that. I'm sure the chat room and our audience will tell us, but
I think they own Adblock plus the other ad blocker. I wouldn't be surprised if maybe IO was somehow involved in this, because it's kind of coincidental that you have, you know, you're going to be allowing the IO ads in as soon as the sale happens. Kind of interesting.
Absolutely true. And of course, this is the opposite direction that I think ad blocking should be going in. It shouldn't be the advertisers who decide whether the advertisers get displayed. It should be the users who decide.
Agreed.
So work on that, somebody. Well, in Hack Attack News, the crowdfunding service Patreon informed its users yesterday that they got hacked and the user data was stolen and leaked online. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that enables content creators and artists to take donations or offer paid subscriptions. Hacked data include registered names, email addresses, posts, and some shipping addresses, in addition to billing addresses stored before 2014. Reports say that something like 2.3 million unique email addresses have been counted among the stolen data posted online. No credit card data was taken, according to the company, nor were passwords or social security numbers. And Christina Warren, you had a tweet about the Experian hack. There's so many hacks, we can't cover them all, but we're not covering the Experian hack today. But in this case, no social security numbers were stolen, but at the Experian hack, they were stolen. Tell us your opinion about this use of social security numbers. Why is it so bad that people use social security numbers as a form of ID?
Well, I mean, at this point, what we've seen now at this point in the U.S. just this year alone, we've had several 10 million plus leaks of social security numbers. And so at this point, I'm saying, how many times do these things have to be hacked before we say this is no longer a valid form of identity, because it can be stolen so easily? And I don't think you can have it both ways. You can't have it be super secret and then also be used for your identity. Is basically kind of my thesis. I think we need to have another way to kind of identify people and not make it so that stealing this number can mean taking over your credit and opening things in your name and ruining, you know, potentially your financial data or even, you know, some of your personal information, the ability to try to, you know, leave and enter countries. Going forward, it's all really problematic when it's tied to this one number. And so I guess kind of my question is what my tweet was kind of saying is, how many of these things have to happen before we say enough? This is no longer a valid form of identity.
This is a particular problem that's weird in the United States, because essentially what's happening is that movements to have a national ID card have been resisted at the state level and all kinds of different levels. So nobody wants a national ID card. People don't like the sound of it. It sounds kind of vaguely fascist to a lot of Americans.
Yes.
And so because that doesn't exist, everybody uses Social Security cards, which are much more easily hacked. And I think I recall years ago, the Social Security cards themselves used to say right on them, do not use for ID. And yet even government agencies use it for ID. It's a horrible form of ID. So in our resistance to a good form of ID, we have a default horrible form of ID. And this is what we get.
This is what we get. I mean, and as you said, you know, the Patreon case, I mean, I don't think they even collect social security numbers. They might for people setting up Patreons, but I'm glad in this case, it seems sad to say this, that it was only email addresses that were leaked. You know, so how bad is it that in 2015, when I read a story like this about the Patreon hack, I almost roll my eyes and go, okay, well, it's just email addresses. And at this point, I think that most of us expect that our email address has probably been exposed to millions of people. And it's all over the place anyway. But at this point, that's not even a concern. It's like, is my credit card information out there? Is my credit information out there? Is my social security number? Is my billing information? Work history, all that sorts of thing. Those are the things that are concerning. An email address is just like, okay, whatever.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can guess somebody's email address in most cases.
Yep.
And so that, yeah, you're right. I mean, the worst case scenario is people are going to get spam, in which case they should be using a spam filter and so on. So I agree with that. It's still a little unnerving. I think that just everything is getting hacked these days. I think the new norm is you just have to assume that your data will be hacked at some point. And so make sure that you're careful about your data. Make sure you're using all the protection you can. Password sites, use two-step authentication when you can, and then cross your fingers, sacrifice a chicken
accounts.
And hope for the best.
I mean, that's one of the things I always tell people too, is multiple accounts. Don't rely on using one email for everything. You know, if you've got certain things, maybe have a different email address for your bank that's different from some of your other, you know, credit cards that's different from maybe, you know, your eBay or your PayPal or something else. That can kind of be annoying. You can have it so maybe they go to one inbox, but, you know, by splitting that up and making it a harder vector, it means that if in some event your email was hacked or was, you know, taken advantage of, then not everything is at least tied to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in just a sec, we're going to tell you about some crazy new hardware coming out of Japan. But first, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter, one of our sponsors today. ZipRecruiter is going to help you hire the ultimate person. Now, this is so good for small businesses. If you own a small business, you do all the hiring yourself, man, ZipRecruiter is fantastic for you because in addition to making it super easy to put your job out there to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, just that one click, in addition to making it super easy for you to weed out the riffraff from the people who respond to your ad and just zero in and spend your time on only the qualified candidates, which is so important. They also make your whole job process look super professional. Your post will have your branding on it. Your email will have your branding on it. They'll set up a web page for you so that job applicants can come and find out more about your company and your job and so on. It is so great to look this professional so easily with ZipRecruiter, and it's super affordable. They even allow you to add as many people involved in the hires as you want at no additional charge. And so, of course, hiring in the best case scenario is always a group activity. You want multiple people involved in that hire, and ZipRecruiter gives you no penalty at all for bringing in other people to help you with those hires. They've been used by more than 400,000 businesses, and you can try it right now for free. And we have a user testimonial from Scott, who is a happy ZipRecruiter client. He said the recruiting process used to be so painful. Before, I'd post to several places, I'd get a million resumes, but only a few responses from qualified candidates. It was torture. But with ZipRecruiter, we post once and get qualified candidates in one easy-to-review place. We've hired some of our best employees using ZipRecruiter. And today, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. In news you could lose, a new LCD monitor from a company called Japan Display has got to break the record for pixels per inch. The 17.3-inch display is an 8K monitor. That adds up to 510 pixels per inch. Unbelievable. Pricing and availability have not been announced. Christina, can the human eye even detect this kind of density?
No, it sure can, but I don't think I care. I want it.
Oh, absolutely. I know. And, you know, it makes like super high density makes a lot of sense for smartphones, as we've discussed on the show a couple of times before, because you're likely in the very near future to be using your smartphone as the display for VR, sort of Google Cardboard right. type of VR. And your eyeballs are going to between you and your eyeballs, which are going to be 2 inches away, there's going to be a magnifying right. glass that's going to magnify those pixels. And so it's a super high pixel density. Great. But if you're looking at a monitor on your desk, I just don't see how anybody could tell.
It does not matter, but it's amazing. I mean, that's really all we need to know is that it's amazing. And you can watch all that 4K content. Oh, wait, there's not any 4K content. You can watch all that 8K content. Oh, wait, there's not any 8K content. But you can play all those games. Oh, wait, there aren't any. But it's still amazing, and I still want one.
Yeah, what you can do is you can say, I have an 8K monitor.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, well, we got some feedback from lots of TNT fans today. John Shuey in Minneapolis said that talking about speed cameras and the balance of power, which is, I was mentioning that the use of speed cameras sort of shifts the balance of power toward the police because it makes them super easy to dish out tickets. In fact, it makes it automated. And he said that this is pure BS. The speed limit is set for a reason. If you're speeding, you're breaking the law and a danger to others, whether you get caught or not. If speed cameras help police do their job and keep their roads safe, this is a good thing. And that, again, comes from John Shuey. And I agree with people obeying the law. I'm not a scuff law, but I do think that there's across the board, you see it in multiple areas, and you end up, if you recall what was the movie Demolition Man with, you know, they lived in a world where every time you use profanity, a ticket would come out of the nearest wall.
Right. It's very Fahrenheit 451, right? Like that case you had speed limits where you had a minimum speed limit. I mean, in this case, I sort of agree. I understand what you're saying. Speed limits are set for a reason, blah, 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 blah. But there's also something called going with the flow of traffic, which these cameras don't allow for. So if you're caught speeding and everyone else is speeding and it's like, yeah, I'm going 10 miles faster because the flow of traffic is going 10 miles faster. And if I go the right speed limit, then I'm actually going to cause an accident. So this is my problem with some of the automated things. A, I think it just becomes a money grab. B, they put them in speed traps where maybe you don't always have control over how fast you're going because you have to keep up with others. And C, kind of like you were saying, it kind of opens up as like, if every time I curse, am I going to be fined? Like, I don't really like living in that sort of state either.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, anyway, we appreciate the note, and that is absolutely a valid perspective.
Definitely.
And I think they're two separate issues. You know, the one is speed cameras, and the other one is the opportunistic use of technology to keep shifting the balance of power in one direction and never
exactly.
in the other. And so I think
it's kind of agreed. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, historically, if it's like the end of the month, you know, it's like you better look out for the cops because they have their quotas to fill. And anybody who tells me people were going to get mail now, cops don't have quotas for speed stuff. Yes, yes, they do. Yeah. I have family members in law enforcement. They absolutely have quotas for how many people they want to catch. And so it kind of, you're right. It shifts the balance away. And and I think anytime that balance is shifted one way or the other, it's bad.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I have to say that I've had this sort of obsession ever since I wrote a column a few years ago called I Want to Live in a Surveillance Society. And what I meant by that is if we're going to have a surveillance society, let's have a surveillance society.
Right.
And let's have, you know, if the police are going to videotape and control the camera in that video deposition or, you know, interrogation, then I get to record it, too. If the police are going to have body cameras, I get to have a body camera. In other words, let's either nobody gets to surveil each other or everybody gets to surveil each other, but we can't be just like that group of people over there get to surveil and those people over there do not. That upsets the balance of power. Anyway, that's my obsession. We got another email from Jim Gennati, who said on your September 30th show, Stephen Hall ranted about the inferiority of Android on a tablet, especially for productivity. And I laughed out loud. While I didn't own an iOS tablet, I did use iOS for 5 years on an iPhone 3GS, iPhone 4, and iPhone 5. And the decision to migrate to Android was entirely a result of my purchase of a 2012 Nexus 7. I now own a Nexus 5 and a 2013 Nexus 7, and I'm waiting for my Nexus 5X. For my use case, which is entirely based on productivity, I don't do games at all, I found Android to be far superior to iOS in every way. Just one guy's opinion, love the show, and watch the podcast every single day, Jim. Yeah, that I knew that would be a controversial point, and that was one example of many such emails that we got on that one. We got another email from Angus McKinnon in West Vancouver in British Columbia in Canada, who sent us an email about our story, which was about a mobile operator called Digicel, who's demanding that Google, Facebook, Yahoo, and other companies with mobile ad networks pay them if they want Digicel to display the ads on customer phones. In that segment, we said Digicel is a Jamaican company. Angus wrote, in December, my guide dog Vaquero and I will be landing on the island of St. Lucia for my fifth trip there. Digicel operates in St. Lucia. Digicel is an Irish company. I know this because one of my friends in St. Lucia is doing a cellular payphone project for Digicel. My cell provider, Rogers, has a deal with Digicel in St. Lucia. Well, I looked into this, Angus, and you are right. The company is owned by an Irish billionaire named Dennis O'Brien. But it's murkier than that. The company is actually incorporated in Bermuda, and its headquarters are in Jamaica. Digicel operates in 33 markets across the Caribbean, Central America, and I was completely surprised by this, Oceania, which includes Australia, New Zealand, et cetera. So this was a surprising fact, and I thank you for bringing it to our attention. Very cool. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Alan Williamson in Richmond, Virginia, who posted this picture on Google+. He says, Tech News Today is his pre-get-out-of-bed routine every morning, which he watches via the Roku app. He highly recommends the show to his followers and says it's such a professionally produced show. Jason, are you listening? It's such a professionally produced show that he's waiting for CNN or the BBC to syndicate it at some point. Keep up the excellent work, chaps. Don't get any funny ideas, Jason. Stay right here. anyway, so show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Christina Warren, what is going on in the world of Christina Warren?
Well, I mean, we've got so much new tech that came out this week, right? I mean, we've got new Chromecast, we've got new phones, we've got all kinds of new stuff. I'm actually going to be seeing the Steve Jobs film at the New York Film Festival tomorrow.
Nice.
So I will be writing a little something on that. And Microsoft got an event next week. I mean, we are really seriously in the middle of tech busy season right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to that that Steve Jobs movie. And of course, that opens on the 9th, I believe, Friday.
It does. It opens at the 9th. Friday the 9th. But it's a screening at the New York Film Festival tomorrow, on Saturday. And so I'm going to one of those shows then. But next week, you know, Microsoft's got their big Surface 4 events. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing the new film, though, for sure. That's I'm a big Danny Boyle fan, a big Aaron Sorkin fan. And what I've seen of the screenplay from the leaked Sony emails makes it look like it's going to be a good film. You know, how accurate it is, I mean, that's always up to debate. I don't necessarily care so much about that as I do care about, can they put on a good story and will actors be able to, you know, say something that's worth saying?
Yeah, and if, they talked to somebody, I believe it was Alan Kay. Was that the guy? No, there was they talked to the. So you know the trailer where Steve Jobs is poking that guy in the chest. He was one of the early designers. I'm yes. spacing on his name right now. Somebody interviewed him recently. He said it was a great movie, not very factual, but a great, great movie that in some ways captured the spirit of what was going on. They interviewed him. The actor interviewed him. They really involved him in this movie, and the Woz liked it. It's being well reviewed. So I think it's going to be a good movie. And this is one of the things that I miss about living in LA and New York. I've lived in both cities, and you can see movies early in those yes. cities, and I miss that. So, and are you looking forward to The Martian?
I am. I'm definitely looking forward to The Martian. I mean, look, anytime we can see Matt Damon in space, it's a good thing. I'm definitely looking forward to The Martian. I also am looking forward to The Walk. There are a lot of good movies happening right now. So, yeah,
absolutely. Well, all right. Well, Christina Warren, film_girl on Twitter. Thank you so much yes. for co-anchoring today. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time, Mike.
Right, bye-bye. Let us know what's on your mind. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or call 260-TNT-SHOW. That's 260-868-7469. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, or you can choose another way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. You can, of course, watch us live every weekday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1700 UTC at twit.tv/live. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me personally on Twitter at Mike Elgin. Don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. And that is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Kevin King. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you Monday.